Brian's Tip Report. Okay, now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. This is Johnny, who is 13 years sober, so please offer him a warm Valley Group welcome.
I know you're not going to believe this, but I'm an alcoholic.
Wow.
Move some stuff out of the way here. Yeah, I guess. By the way, can you hear me? I remember the good old days. They told me to shut up and sit down. Like I said, my name's John. I'm an alcoholic. And welcome to all the newcomers. My goodness, it's good to see you here. I was looking around the room. Some of you know me real well and saw me go through some of my drinking days, because I did a lot of it right here in AA. I was one of those that always wanted to look good and show up above everybody else. So I thought I'd come to AA and prove you guys wrong about all the things that you told me would happen if I kept doing what I was doing. And they happened right here in AA, you know. If you're a newcomer here, I may have 13 years, a month and a half or so, but you know what? Got the same day you got today. Yesterday's history, tomorrow's a mystery, and today's reality. You know? So anyway, I try to live in today, and I wanted to start by, first of all, I was going to do something. My wife was going to come tonight, and something came up. She couldn't come, and even though she's not here, I want to thank her for all the years that we've been married 38 years, going on 39 years, and I put her, I took her to hell and back, is what I did. And, you know, she walked through it with me, stuck with me, and that's a miracle in itself, and I know some of you guys know my wife. She's a real sweetheart. I just wanted to read something in starting. It says, "The willingness to give up my pride and self-will to a power greater than myself is proves to be the only ingredient absolutely necessary to solve all of my problems today. Even the smallest amount of willingness, if sincere," and that to me really stood out, "if sincere is sufficient to allow God to enter and take control over any problems, pain, or obsession. My level of comfort is in direct relationship to the degree of willingness I possess at any moment to give up my self-will and allow God's will to be manifested in my life. With the key of willingness, my worries and fears are powerfully transformed into serenity." And you know, today I have some serenity. I never really had a life until I ended up in AA. Looking back, it wasn't a life at all. It was miserable. I was never happy. I looked good. You know, I was kind of a pillar of the community. I walked the fence, you know, on both sides of the sign. I could do this side at night and do that during the day. And anyway, to tell you a little bit about my story, and you know, it's hard to put into words in just a few minutes. Got all of the story and the wreckage and the stuff that happened in my life. But so I kind of broke it down into a little narrative. I made some notes because, you know, and Bill called, I talked a couple of years ago, and Bill called me up and asked if I'd speak, and I said, yeah. And right after I hung up, I thought, what the crap I do that for, you know? And I spent a good day or two trying to figure out a good way to call him up and convince him that I had forgot I had another appointment. Or then I thought, honesty, you know, they're going to know, you know. And then, of course, I had to live with myself, see? So you guys ruined my deceitfulness, and so I had to start getting honest. Anyway, I talked, and what I do after I got done talking for the next week, I went and played everything back in my head. Oh, I shouldn't have said this. Oh, my God, what did I say that for? Oh, I wonder what they think of me, you know? So I kind of gotten through that a little bit. Bill called. He's back in Florida. I talked to him last night, and told him I'd be here. He was checking on me, and I said, I sure will. But anyway, I was born in Bakersfield in 1944, back in the war days, and that's where my life really started taking a turn for exactly the next few years of wreckage and destruction and problems. The day I came home from the hospital, and I didn't know this until I met my mother 15 years later, but the day I came home from the hospital, she lived in Oildale in a cul-de-sac on Dinah Way there, and she
Could you bring me my water? Could you bring my water to me? Here, I'm here.
Thanks. Get a little dry mouth to take medication for my heart. But anyway, I do have a heart. Anyway, the day I came home from the hospital, my mother, husband, and ex-husband were both in the cul-de-sac, and they were fighting over whose kid I was. And you know that term, who's your daddy? I don't know. One died of drunkenness, and the other blew himself up in a motel down in Long Beach after he got out of jail. He forgot. He got up in one of the old hotels up in the second story there, according to the coroner's office, and tried to light a cigarette on the old stove, the gas stove. The pilot wasn't lit, so he went down the hall and had a few beers with a buddy down the hall and got some matches and came back, walked in the room, had another beer, lit up a cigarette, and blew himself clear out onto the pavement. So that's what alcoholism will do for you. And, you know, anyway, when we got back in the cul-de-sac, she got out of the car holding me, and they were fighting, and one of them tried to grab me, and I was flipped out. My mom said, onto the pavement. I had a head injury and internal injuries and was in the hospital as a little baby for quite a while. And once I got out, I stayed there with my mom. And of course, I didn't know. I was too little. But anyway, at age two, back then it was an award of state to call it CPS, now stepped in. And I was put in an orphanage down in Riverside County. And I stayed in that orphanage in and out until I was 15 years old. I'd be in the orphanage. I don't know if you ever saw Cider House Rules. I was placed in the orphanage, and back in those days, people didn't have a lot of money, and they were always volunteering to take kids for a few days and get some money from the state. And there was a lot of abuse in those families, and I ended up being an abused kid. Ended up at White Memorial Hospital with malnutrition, rheumatic fever, pneumonia. I'd been abused, and anyway, after they got me healthy, they put me back in that orphanage again, and I kept running off once in a while, by the way. I wasn't always a really good kid. I think it was a Catholic one. I don't really remember what it was. They just dressed like one of those kind of orphanages, you know, and walking around like a little mom with a stick all the time, and told to be quiet, but did teach us. We had a classroom, and anyway, I kept running off and getting caught and put back in there, and I remember. I was supposed to be cleaning the office. I didn't know who my mother was. I didn't know where I even came from. And I was old enough to start wondering about this. So what I did, I was cleaning the office one day at the orphanage, and there was a file cabinet there. So I snuck into the file cabinet, found my name on a file, pulled it out, and there's a copy of my birth certificate. Found out my mother lived and who my dad on the birth certificate and the address. I ran off. And I looked my mother up and went up and knocked on the door, and my mom was there, came to the door, and that was quite an experience in itself. Anyway, she took me in, and I stayed with her for a short time, and you know, later on in my drinking days, I had a resentment over, why did you do that? Why did you do that to me? You know? My mother passed away a few years ago, and we became extremely close. And she told me, she says, you know, it was a good thing they stepped in. In those days, we didn't have any money. I made poor choices when it come to men, and I thought you'd be better off somewhere else. And I had to give you up. And I remember the first night I stayed there in that house, gave me a room, and I'm just a nervous wreck, you know. And so I go to bed, and it was real quiet. All the lights were out, and I heard somebody paddling through the house and back in, coming into the room, and I laid facing the wall and act like I was asleep, and I felt this somebody sit down behind me. Now, just keep in mind, I'd only met my mom a little earlier that day, and she'd placed the chair behind me, and I felt, sat there for a while, real quiet, and I'm going, what in the world, you know, and I felt her hand come up and just kind of rub my cheek and stuff. And you know, I look back and I can understand where she came from. And I love my mother. My mother never said a swear word in my life, never had a drink in her life, and never smoked. She just didn't. Just poor choice of men. I stayed there about 6-8 months. She's married to a guy who was a truck driver, and he's a mean alcoholic. He'd come home and he'd beat the crap out of me. He didn't like my being there. He resented it. And I left. But the next morning after the first day I met my mom, and that night, the next day in the morning, she cooked breakfast and went in the living room to sit down, and then up pulls this little 40 Ford coupe. Neat car. And these two guys got out, and this girl got out, real cute chick, you know, and they came into the house, and I didn't know who they were. And my mom says, I want you to meet somebody. This is your brother Jimmy, this is your brother David, and this is your sister Caroline. And my sister is married to a doctor. She lives up in Roanoke Park, and we're real close. I got to be very, very close with my two brothers. All of a sudden, I had a family. Even though I moved out because of the abuse by her husband, I moved in the converted garage back at my grandmother's house. And it was about 8 or 9 months. It was on Memorial Day weekend. My two brothers decided to go out and see our other grandmother, lived out in Button Willow, and they had two buddies, Louis Ricky and Melvin and Tangiovanni. My brothers were Jimmy and David Perucci, which is my birth name, and Italian boys, and they're in high school. And I had just started North High School in Oildale there. And they wanted me to go with them. I said, no, it's too crowded in the car. And my sister had come over, and she wanted me to go with her. And I said, no, I'll go with sis. And it was all new to me. And we were there about 2 hours later. The sheriff's department pulled up the coroner's office. And Jimmy and David and both the other boys were killed in a car wreck. And it was one of the hardest times of my life. It really was. I continued going to school, and I didn't have any money, and lived in this little converted garage, and I'd go up and down the alleys at night picking up pop bottles and nickel apiece, and, you know, just trying to survive. A couple of buddies came over and wanted me to go down. I found an old bicycle ride. They had bicycles. I said, well, let's ride down to the little hamburger joint and get some hamburgers. We went around the back of a Safeway store, and there's a Coors truck. I'll never forget it. Tommy grabbed a whole bunch of beer, and so did Roger, and some Fritos, and we went back to the house, and I'd never drank before, and Tommy and Roger had, you know, and so they popped those cans of warm beer. They didn't care. They were drinking that beer, and so I started to drink that beer, and how's anybody drink this stuff? You know, so I just gulped it down, and about a minute or two later, it's like, whoa. I just found heaven. I don't know if an alcoholic was born, but it was then. You know, whether I was born one or not, but from that point on, I was. I still remember it. I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned that. My thinking back then was, they're going to drink it all, and I won't have any. And so I'm waiting until they're not looking, and I took one of the six packs and hid it behind the couch. Alcoholic thinking. You know, where am I going to get my next drink? And I got so blooming sick. I was just, never drank before. But anyway, I got so blooming sick and throwing up and throwing up and throwing up. I could still see those Fritos coming up. And to this day, I don't like Fritos. You know? But somebody told me, well, you might be allergic to the hops. You shouldn't drink beer. So now I got an allergy. So I thought, well, what do I do? Because, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we learn that we are searching all the time for something to make it better. Somebody says, well, drink wine. So I drank wine and got sick. They said, well, there's an awful lot of sugar in it. You probably have a sugar imbalance. So I said, well, crap, you know, I need something. So he said, well, how about screwdrivers, orange juice, good for you, and vodka, it's healthy. So I did, and I got sick. Actually ended up in the hospital drinking those one time. Anyway, I found out it had a lot of acid in it, so now I got an acidity problem. Never once did it dawn on me that maybe I just ingested too much alcohol. You know, never dawned on me at all, you know. A lot of things didn't dawn on me right. You got to remember, growing up in the foster homes and orphanages, I didn't have mentoring. I mentored myself. That's why I'm here. Anyway, I kept going to school, and I would drink occasionally. I didn't really drink a whole lot, but when I did, I got drunk. And I was always searching, you know, different kinds of drink, different ways to feel different. In 1963, I actually got married. My mother's house, standing in the living room, to a little girl I went to high school with. And I got a job in a funeral home. The guy that helped with my brother's funeral kind of took me under his wing and wanted me to go to work for him, so I did. And he actually sent me to Mortuary Science College down in Cyprus. And I graduated from there with an AA, and I got my embalmer's license and funeral director's license and a license for crematory. And I had a career. I came back, and guess what happened? Uncle Sam wanted me. 17 days, I lost my deferment, and off I went into the Army. I went to Fort Ord, Fort Polk, Louisiana. And from there, they flew me to Travis Air Force Base and straight to Vietnam. I went straight into combat. That was in 1960. I went in 66, but I went to Vietnam in 67, 68. Some of you guys in the military probably can remember that time. It was a big buildup in Vietnam. I became a sergeant in a weapons platoon, the 25th Infantry Division, fighting out in the jungles, where my tour was a year. And I've got a tremendous amount of friends that are on the wall, and a lot of buddies that to this day are pretty severely injured. And I'm friends with families that their sons got killed over there, and I've got to know their family, and through them I kind of, you know, it was a healing process. It took a long time to work that out. Anyway, I fought over there, you know, in the jungles, and I used to walk around saying the 23rd Psalm and telling God if I ever got out of there, I'd never have another drink. I'd be the best boy you've ever seen, and all those kind of things. And I wouldn't say a swear word. They used to call me, even though I was Sergeant Brother Bond, you know. And lo and behold, as soon as I got back, man, went to the bar and got a drink, you know. Went out back puking and saying, oh, God, help me get through this, and I'll never do it again. But, you know, I continued on. Anyway, when I was in the service, I had 11 days to go, and I went in April 3rd over there in 1967. I was going to get out April 3rd and ETS back to the States. And in March 26th, I was on an ambush patrol. There was 14 of us on that ambush patrol. As near as I can tell, because of all the confusion and the way it all happened, we walked into an ambush at night when we were on patrol. I got hit. Besides getting hit, I had a serious head trauma. I ended up in 12 evac hospital and shipped home on a medevac to San Francisco, in and out of the hospital for quite a while to get things right. But anyway, I made it. I made some notes so I can try to stay on track here. I continued my education. When I came back from Vietnam, went back to work in a funeral home, and I thought, you know, I'm just tired of the death and destruction. I can't do this anymore. I just got to make a change. And I was going to school, and I knew the president and CEO and chairman of the board of a bank in Bakersfield, and I met him in Kiwanis. I'd become a member of Kiwanis there, and he asked me, he said, how would you like to go into banking? And I said, hey, I never thought about it. He said, well, come down and talk to me. So I did. I went on a management training program. Probably some of you might have worked in a bank. If you did, my management training program, I started out as a teller, vault teller, new accounts, ran approved machines, you know, went to the note department, and then over into operations officer, over on the platform, and I was continuing my education. I got my bachelor's, and went through some banking classes and stayed sober pretty much of the time. When I did, it was on a weekend or night or some function. I'd get drunk, but I always made sure I looked good. Nobody knew what was going on about drinking too much. And so I didn't really get heavy into it. But anyway, I ended up assistant vice president, a branch manager, and then a vice president, branch manager of the Stockdale branch in Bakersfield. And in 1972, I got transferred up here to Visalia. And I brought my wife up, and during that, in 1970, we had our first son, John, whom I'm very close to these days. In fact, I'm close with all my children today, and I have three sons and a daughter. All three boys have had problems with this disease. Right at the moment, they're all doing good. Anyway, I got transferred up here with a bank and built another branch out on Mooney and ran both of those. And I ended up in a divorce. When I came back from Vietnam, my wife had been unfaithful, and I'd forgiven her, and it tore me up. And that pattern continued. Even though I transferred up here, it happened again. And I said, enough's enough. I can't take this. And that's when my drinking really took a turn for the worse. I didn't know how to handle it. It was emotionally just tormenting me inside. My guts were raw, and you know, I never had any family, and here I got a wife, and I have kids, and you know, it was horrible. So I met my friend Mr. Smirnoff, and he took care of me for a while, you know, and so I started drinking, and then the bank wanted to transfer me. I said, no, I'm tired of transferring. I don't want to transfer anymore. I was still going to school, even though I was working, and I got my master's from Fresno State. I got an MBA, and I also graduated from West Coast School of Banking and Management. I got my broker's license and went into real estate in 1977. Anyway, that gave me the freedom to run around during the day on my own. So I could, you know, get up in the morning, put a suit and tie on, go look good, make some money, and then go down to the depot and have lunch with the buddies and a few more, and, you know, and drink in the afternoon. And about 4 o'clock, I'd head home, and what I do, you know, I call them my shit kickers. I put on my cowboy boots and my Levi's, and anybody saw me doing that knew I was headed out the door, and I was going to go have some fun. And this happened a lot, and it got worse and worse and worse and worse. And I got remarried, by the way, in 1978. Married a real sweet little gal. She used to work for me at the bank, and after I'd left the bank, she'd gotten a divorce, and we got together. We're still married. It'll be 39 years in April. And she's been a real blessing too, by the way. We had two children, Ryan, Mike, and then the other two were John and Jody. And I've got one son getting married next month, getting married at the 18th hole of Pebble Beach. The girl that he's marrying manages Pebble Beach. So he's kind of lucky there. Too bad I don't golf. I used to. I'd made it 9 holes in the clubhouse, and the back 9 went to hell. You know? I made lots of money, and when I made lots of money, my ego got bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, and I've always been an achiever because I found out that that makes me look good, you know. I used to run around bragging about, look what I've accomplished, look what I own, look what I've done, and if I did something for Mike down here, I'd go tell Courtney over there, hey, look how great I am, you know what I did for Mike, you know, that's the kind of life, that's the way it was, and if somebody said something good about you, I'd say, yeah, but did you know, you know? Because I felt like I was inferior. He might look better than me, you know? And my self-worth was all based on my pocketbook and what you thought of me, you know? I went through that and I was living two lives, you know? I belonged to the country club. ambassador of the Chamber of Commerce, owned my own real estate firm, lived in a big house, don't you know who I am, but yet I was on that line of like, okay, Hyde and Jekyll, tonight I want to go out, but I'm going to go out on the other side of town. Sometimes I went out of town and partied so nobody'd catch me, you know, or know or say something about me. I didn't want to be labeled an alcoholic and a drug addict. And by the way, I did a lot of that stuff. They seem to go hand in hand. I know we talk about alcoholism, but just in case you're an addict, anytime I say alcohol tonight, you can just add cocaine to that. And to prove it, I did a lot of window peeking and tweaking and taking furniture apart, looking for the bug. And anyway, it progressed to a lot of wreckage. Now here I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the wife and my mother-in-law off my back. They told me I drank too much, and I thought, you know what? Up yours. I'll just go to AA and they'll think I'm getting better. And I would come home and brag about the things I heard here. That it's not a perfect program, you know. Meaning it's okay to drink once in a while. That's the way I put it. Now, I'd never been in trouble with the law. I'd never gotten a DUI, public intoxication. Never been in trouble with anything. I had a clean record other than a ticket or two. But, you know, I came into AA in 1988, and I didn't sober up until 2003. On the 17th of April, and that's how long it took me to get honest. When I came into AA, you know, I heard all this stuff. I wouldn't like you people. I didn't like you. My idea of an addict and alcoholic, just you not good people, you know. The image that I'd been presented with as a kid growing up, an alcoholic's a weak person. Long old overcoat, never shaved, stunk, peed his pants, got a brown thing with a bottle. That's what I thought an alcoholic was, and I wasn't like that. I could wear a suit and tie and drive a nice car, and don't you know who I am? I'm not lying. I'm smart, see? When I got here, I was the smartest guy in Tulare County. You know, and you guys ruined that. Anyway, you were talking about character defects. I had character qualities when I got here. You know? I didn't understand any of this stuff. What do you mean? I'm a good person. Yeah, so I drink a little bit. But look what I've accomplished. How could I have defects, you know? I found out I do have defects. You know, it was a long process for me. People used to say, David Looper, why do you mess with that guy? He's not going to get sober. He don't want to get sober. David says, you know what? He must want it because he keeps coming, even if he's drinking and nobody makes him come. And, you know, I'm glad he didn't run me out the door. You know, David says, you never look down on an alcoholic unless you're reaching down to pick him up. And he stuck with me. And he taught me a lot, even though I wouldn't listen a lot of times. It would register later, you know. So anyway, I ended up getting 3 DUIs, 2 public intoxications. I would do stuff like David would take me to Pine, and I'd wake up. Where am I? He says, oh, you're in detox. I'm out of here. I'd go down the street to thrift, get a bottle, walking across 198, tripped on a curb, broke my fist of vodka, heard boop, boop, took me in on a public intoxication, you know. I don't know. It just kind of went that way. Never buy a Buick. Mine always stopped at the liquor stores, you know. I got charged with batteries. I had a spousal abuse charge, which I'm not proud of. And, you know, the whole time I'm attending AA. I'm AA. I would go to AA meeting. I had the ability and learned how to shine. And I would come in with a suit and tie on it, and I could learn this. And, oh, man, I could get up and say some really profound things, you know. And then leave, go home, change clothes, go on the north side and meet somebody. And I see you smiling, me, see. Anyway, I lived a lot over here on the streets and in motel rooms and nights and not coming home and disappearing and wrecking cars. I had a habit of wrecking cars. to give you, for instance, a little bit about some of my behavior. I was on vacation. I would come into AA and lie about stuff. I'd pick up chips I didn't really have, you know. David Looper showed up at my house one time. He says, "You got a box?" I said, "What for?" He said, "You know, put all those chips in. You're going to go to a meeting over here with me and Tulare, and you're going to get honest." I had enough chips to take care of the entire county. I went to Santa Barbara. This is the insanity. I went to Santa Barbara on vacation with my wife. And so at the motel we're staying there on Cabrillo, right, West Beach Inn, right across from the yacht club, they have happy hour about 5 o'clock in the evening out by the pool. And, of course, I think I had about 20 days sobriety or something. And I says, "You're not going to drink?" I said, "No, I'm going to an AA meeting." And I knew one down at Cattell, I knew where it was at. It's called the Sundowner Group, if you've ever been there. It's a big, huge building, a lano club, hardwood floors, and the doors were open because it's summertime and a nice breeze coming through. And on the way there, there's a liquor store. So I walked into the liquor store and bought a half pint of vodka. And I thought, you know what? The wife will never know. I just have one, you know. So I went around back of the building and drank half that half pint. And I put the other one in my boot and put my Levi's over it. And just before I got down the alarm clock, I thought, shoot, I'll run out. So I went back, drank the other half out behind the building, bought another half pint, put it in my boot, went and sat in a meeting. And they start the meeting, and this is how dishonest you can get, or I was anyway. Do we have any newcomers? Anybody from out there? "Oh, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic from Vice A," you know. So what do? They take a little break, and I think, I got to have a drink. So I went in the bathroom, and I'm taking a big swig, and this guy walks in, and so I put the cap on and put it down in my pants, see? And I went outside and sit down. And he's standing there talking to me, and I'm sitting there like, I hope he doesn't smell it. And so, lo and behold, the first one, I'd like to hear from our visitor from out of town. So I get up, I go up the podium, and I just say all those beautiful things I've learned in AA that sound really good. I think I probably told him I had 10 years, I don't know. And I begin to feel this wet, cold something down my crotch. And anyway, I got done, and I start to walk away, and I felt the boot. It had gone through my shorts. It was going down the side leg. And as I'm walking away, I thought, I hope it goes in the boot. It didn't. It came out. I hit it with my other boot. It went spinning clear across that wooden floor. I started to our seat, turned, and went out the door and straight up the street. You know, I had to go back and make amends, you know. There was another time I had a brand new car. I just wrecked one car and went and ordered another car. It came in, beautiful sedan. Called my wife up and said, "My car's in. Hey, let's go to dinner tonight." She said, "Okay," because she was working. I said, "I'll pick you up at 7 o'clock. She says, "Good, great. Looking forward to it. How do you like cars?" "Love it." Well, I'm at the depot. So anyway, I start drinking, celebrating, you know. Huh. 7 o'clock comes around. What am I doing? She can wait. What the hell, you know? She's probably not home yet anyway, you know. I have one more, you know. And so anyway, about 8 o'clock, I pull up in the driveway, put the garage door up, and pull in. And the door to the house is right there, and she's standing in it. And she's unloading on me. I have the window down with a car running, and she's giving me hell. "Now, I'm not going now. You know what time it is." And we get in a screaming match. She says, "John, the neighbors are going to hear." And she puts the garage door down and kept on yelling at me. Finally, "Screw you." Threw it in reverse, and guess what I did? I stomped that thing, came out of there, took the whole garage door off, side of the garage, the whole pole and thing comes out. The car spun around into the front yard, ruined the car. I couldn't get out the driver's side because I'd ripped into the side of the garage paneling there. So I climb in the back seat, I get out, and she's standing there, and I walk up and say, "Now look what you made me do." That's just the way I thought. Now look what you made me do. So I go and get her car. Don't you take my car. I says, it ain't your car. I bought it for you. I paid for it. It's my car. And I get in it and I back up. And I come down and we live in a cul-de-sac over here. And I come out of the cul-de-sac. I'm looking back. All the lights are on. The neighbors are coming out. And I'm looking at them. And I'm driving. I come around the corner and ran right smack into the back of my neighbor's El Camino. Showed her. You know, that's the kind of stuff I did. And so they towed the car down to Putnam Wynn, and Carl Wynn, the owner, one of the owners, and Pat Putnam called me up and said, hey, John, what are you going to do about this car? I said, oh, he says, well, it don't look too good. He said, why don't you come down, instead of buying them fancy cars, why don't you come down and test drive? He said, I've got a beautiful Park Avenue Ultra loaded. He said, it's a demo. Come down and drive it. Try it out for a couple of days. Well, I didn't have a car. I might as well. So I went down. Guess what I did with that? That very afternoon, I was already drunk, and I was going up Old Dinuba Highway to meet somebody, you know who, and I had a fifth of vodka, and it rolled over and went down on the driver's side, and right there by Fairway Market, I'm trying to grab that bottle, and I can't get it, and I'm not looking. I ran right smack in the back of a car, turning left, and she was spun around, hit two cars coming this way. Nobody got hurt, but I totaled out that loner, you know. That's insanity. That's insanity. I became a recluse. I got to where I didn't go out in public. My body said I had to have that drink. I got so bad. I was in and out of the hospitals too, sick. Today I weighed 205. I weighed 103 pounds. It was jaundice. I had life supports on me one time. I collapsed out on Chenoweth Avenue. In bad, bad shape. I just couldn't stop. I got so bad I just laid in bed with a fifth of vodka on the nightstand, and I would drink. I'd wake up and I'd drink, and I'd just back in bed, and it just went on. And the only time I went somewhere is I wake up in the morning and I'd go, where's the bottle? And I'd run down to Martin Bottle. The lady there says, I can't sell you anymore. You're killing yourself. Ann worked there. It was sad. But you know what? I finally just, I had about 11 different charges. That I had DUIs, I got two back-to-back, and all this other stuff, the court and everything, but I couldn't stop. And so we called the doctor, my wife did, and he gave me some detox medication, and somebody suggested I go to U-Turn for Christ down in Paris, California, and I went down there. It was a 60-day program. It wasn't a Hilton. I got there to the working ranch out in the desert, and I looked around, and well, they don't have no therapists. You know, they don't have no AA. They don't have this. It was all AA based. The first day I got there was late in the afternoon. The next morning I got up and I was walking across the yard. I was going to leave. I ain't got nothing here. And I've given up on life. It's terrible. And these three guys walked over to me that were working there, and they came over and said, hey, you leaving? I go, yeah. Ain't nothing here, man. This is just a hole. And he said, well, wait a minute. Talk to us, you know. And the three guys got around me and said, hey, why don't we give it a chance? You know, we've been here for a while. Just give it a day or two. We'll stick right with you. How about we just buddy up with you the next couple of days or so, and we'll help you walk through it. And then if you want to leave, you can, you know. And would you mind if we prayed with you? And I says, no. So they put their arms around and prayed for me, you know, and what have you. And I went back in this bunkhouse where there's 60 other guys, you know, except they're all out working. We worked and also worked the program. Anyway, I went back in, and that was the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous, beginning to love me until I could love myself. That's when three guys in Alcoholics Anonymous came over and surrounded me. They told me, you're not a bad person, John. You're okay. You're one of God's kids. You know, you made some mistakes, but you know what? We can clean all that up. We'll help you with that. That's AA working in my life. That's God working through AA members in my life. And you know, I went back. That night I was laying in that bunkhouse and lights were out, and I just broke down. I was laying on my back in the bottom bunk. guy snoring all over and stinky feet, you know, and I just broke down and cried. And I remember saying, God, if you're for real, then you're going to have to show me. You're going to have to prove it to me. You're going to have to come down here. You're going to have to, whatever you do, climb inside of me, whatever, take over. I don't care. But if you're for real, do it. And then keep showing me so that I don't get well later if you're for real and things change. And I just think, oh, I could have done it. You got to stick with me. But come down here and prove you're real, please. And I just surrendered, you know. The fear of what all this stuff is gone. I just was in so much pain. You know, the next morning I woke up and I got up and I had a different feeling. It was just like, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And you know, I completed that program and I came back and I cleaned all that wreckage up. 52 weeks of anger management, DUI classes, 480 hours of community service, and 6 months of the place out here, and did that on a work furlough, and I went back to AA immediately. They told me when I left there, you need to get a sponsor. I said, I know, I've heard, but I didn't understand any of it. But I came in and I got a sponsor, and I didn't understand. Well, how do you work a book? How do you work steps or something? You climb them, or you read it and toss it? Or it took me asking and reaching out for a sponsor who was willing to take the time to explain to me. You know, I didn't think anybody explained that life had become unmanageable, and that it was going to take a power greater than myself. And I knew that one was God. And at a U-turn, that's where I started that. And then when I got into AA with my sponsor, he took me under his wing and he started teaching me how to work those steps. You know, how to surrender and how to take my inventory. That was hard for me. Nothing wrong with me. And you know, a lot of heated times, but we walked through it and we stayed sober. And he you know, I did a fourth step and then a fifth step. And he sat down with me and I told him all my stuff, and he taught me to think about, why did I do those things? What were the thought processes behind them? And what would you do different today? And those kind of things, you know. I made amends, you know. I remember the first time I was going to make my first amend. I was going to the Lana Club to go to a noon meeting. And I saw a lady gardening as I passed her house. She's planting flowers. And I thought, oh, I need to make amends to that lady. Because I really was obnoxious and rude to her down at the Depot restaurant a few days before. And I thought, I need to make amends. So I swung the car over and got out, walked across the street, and I said, hi, how are you? Do you remember me? She says, oh, yeah, I remember you. And she's taking her gloves off. And I said, well, I need to apologize for my behavior when last time I saw you. And she's standing there staring at me. And I'm expecting her to say, oh, it's fine. It's no problem, Johnny. Hey, we all, you know, that didn't happen. She says, are you done? You can go now. Turn around and walk in. I'm so mad I want to get in the car and drive through her flowers, you know. That's the way I did. And so anyway, I went down. David Looper says, well, you did it for all the wrong reasons. You don't go and make amends so they all tell you you're great and everything. What they do with it's their business. But you did your part, you know. You did your part. You know, I got involved in AA, and I'm really grateful for AA, and I'll tell you why. I never really had a life until I got sober, and AA taught me how to feel and how to live and what honesty's about and how to help other people to stay focused in today, to appreciate fellow alcoholics as well as my neighbors, and stay focused on life. And life's not all about me anymore. It's about you and doing things for other people. You know, for 13 years I worked on cleaning up things, and it's been real, real nice. I've got a family now that enjoys being around me, and cars aren't wrecked, and you know, the whole thing is good. I go to about 4 or 5 meetings a week. I'm the treasurer of my home group. They trust me with the money now. That's kind of neat. I do H&I with Bill. We go out to Corcoran and what have you. I've got a couple guys I'm sponsoring, and all of which helps me stay sober. Because I couldn't do it alone. All of you guys sponsor me. And if you're new here, when I came here and went to Utah, I didn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. I thought my entire life was over. How am I even going to live? I have nothing. Everything I worked for, I wrecked and ruined. And you know, if you do the right things, things change. One day at a time. One day at a time. And so, you know, yesterday's history. Tomorrow's a mystery. And today is reality. And I ask God to guide me through it. Thank you.